Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at Steinway & Sons, and for the online music magazine, listenmusicculture.com. My guest today is Steinway artist Scott Price, who is musical director for Celine Dion, one of the best-selling artists of all time, with record sales of over 200 million copies worldwide. I caught up with Price at his office in Montreal before he embarked on a tour of Asia with Dion. Let's talk classical music real quickly.
Yeah, love to.
Because before you got away professionally from classical, you were classically trained.
Yeah, I started piano actually kind of late. I started around 7 or 8 years old, typical suburban boy taking lessons a little bit to please his mother. But I ended up really enjoying it. And I had a really good teacher to give me a really good beginning, fundamentals, like when I think back on it now. The theory that, I learned all my chords and scales and transposition and chords and blah, blah, blah. I studied with the program from the Royal Conservatory of Music of Toronto. I didn't go to Toronto, but they send examiners to every major city in Canada twice a year, and you have a syllabus where you have to play certain pieces from certain periods, and it goes up to grade 10, and then you get a diploma, which is an ARCT, which is an associate of the Royal Conservatory of Toronto. I took a couple pauses along the way. I got my ARCT, I think, when I was 21 or 22. I've never abandoned classical music as far as playing at home and playing for love, but I didn't have the discipline as a young child to become a virtuoso. Like, I started to really, really practice hard when I turned 15, 16. I fell in love with the band Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Oh, sure.
And I realized that Keith Emerson, hey, this guy can really play.
He has actual chops.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he was brilliant in so many ways. And one of them was that he would incorporate classical works into their performances, and he adapted stuff and arranged stuff and everything. That really, really tweaked my ears. So then I started to hit it and do scales and technique and really, really get into it. And that's from that point on, I became really, really serious about music and never really did anything else.
Are there works you find yourself coming back to, whether at home on the piano or...
The Goldberg Variations. Mm-hmm. Like, I it's funny, you go through phases. About 15 or 20 years ago, I thought Beethoven was the end of the world and I would never play anything else other than Beethoven. I haven't played any Beethoven, like I don't play it professionally, but for fun, I can't leave it alone. But I haven't played Beethoven probably in the last 10 years, but now I feel myself starting to become interested in it again. Like, I think the real classics, Mozart, Brahms, Bach, Beethoven, you never lose interest in that. And it's funny, I'm 57 years old now, only in the last 4 years I started to really play any Chopin. I started playing the ballads. I'm working on the fourth one now. I learned the first one. I can't play it like Horowitz or anything, but I mean, I can bash through it, you know. It's like, my goodness, I should have started this 30 years ago, Chopin. Right now, I've discovered another composer. When I was on tour with Celine last year, we were on a bus, and this trumpet player played me this wild piano piece, and I said, who's that? And it was Nikolai Kapustin. Do you know Nikolai Kapustin?
Yes, I do.
And he has these Opus 53 24 jazz preludes, so I'm working on that now. I really like that because it's a language that speaks to me. It's really modern. The fact that there isn't a 200-year-old tradition behind it kind of makes it easier for somebody like me, too.
It straddles a lot of genres in a happy way.
It's true. Like, the guy, what a whiz. Like, he's obviously an exceedingly huge, complex musical mind.
Thank you. So maybe that's a good transition to Celine, who herself, growing up in Quebec and straddling that very unique Francophone culture right. that we have here. I speak a little French, and every conversation I have has some mélange of French and English. When we were in college and we took a year in France, we'd call that franglais.
That's very good. That's what I was going to say. That's what we call it here.
Yeah, but it's a very natural situation here because you have a group of people who are generally fluent 100% in both and easily shift back and forth as needed
Correct.
In the conversation.
And some concepts, like those are the only two languages that I'm fluent in, English and French. Some concepts, I'm sure you agree, are better expressed in a certain language. So that's one reason why we switch back and forth so much. It's just like to make yourself understood faster.
That's exactly right. There's a certain transparency in certain French concepts, and I imagine vice versa.
Correct.
Celine Dion started as more of a French language, say, centric.
She was completely a French-Canadian singer.
J'irai chercher ton cœur si tu l'emportes ailleurs, même si dans tes danses d'autres dansent des heures. J'irai chercher ton âme dans les froids, dans les flammes. Je te jetterai des sorts pour que tu m'aimes encore.
Woman who preceded her, a very different physical presence and a very different voice and a very different personality. She's a woman named Ginette Reno, who was a huge star in Quebec. And I think she had chances to expand her horizons, but I think she got a little bit cold feet.
L'essentiel, c'est d'être aimé. Le reste importe peu. La seule vérité, c'est compter pour quelqu'un, quoi qu'il puisse arriver. C'est entrer dans son cœur et n'en sortir jamais. C'est recevoir autant qu'on aimerait donner. Ne plus s'appartenir, en être rassuré.
What's ironic is that her manager at the time was René Angélil, who ended up managing Celine.
And marrying Celine.
Correct.
Yes.
Right. Celine sort of followed in the beginning in that tradition, like a big belter, big ballads. French-Canadian Quebecois music has always been big on that, like female singers that can really sing full tilt, big heartfelt ballads. I think though at a certain point, Celine, when she turned 17, 18, because previously before that, she did a lot of records of three or four albums with a French lyricist, French from France, and the subjects were very fitting to a 14-year-old girl, like my boyfriend left me and family and stuff like that. But when she turned 17, 18, you could see a switch, and I think I get the feeling that Celine did something like the equivalent of staying in her bedroom with a hairbrush as a fake microphone, and she went through everything. She went through Barbra Streisand, Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin, because Celine, honestly, yes, I work for her and she's my boss, but she's so impressive. She can sing anything, and she's got soul and she's got chops, and I don't think she's obviously still practices voice and studies, takes voice lessons, but she's never, I could be wrong here, but I don't think she's ever studied classical vocal technique. I would be fascinated to hear her do a little more of that. Obviously she does little things like the air from Carmen that everybody knows. And she sounds classical, but I mean, I've never heard her sing a leader or something like that, but I'm sure she could do it.
I think she could too. And I think that's, you know, that's also one of the misconceptions is that there needs to be this barrier to entry to classical.
Right. The first huge show I worked on with Celine was in 2008. It was for the 400th anniversary of Quebec City, and her band was unavailable. So they hired me and a bunch of people here from Montreal because I was pretty well known in the live scene and studio scene and pretty well everything scene at the time. And that was the first time she worked with a small orchestra, but it was still a 15-piece string section and a couple of French horns and some other horns. I know that after that is when she incorporated the orchestra into her Vegas show. And when we were working on all the string stuff, sometimes we'd be rehearsing with just the strings and Celine. And it's been 10 years that we've been saying we have to do a record of Celine with just a string orchestra or Celine piano and string orchestra because it leaves so much space for her voice. And I honestly think that's going to happen eventually, maybe like in the next 5 years.
I'm so interested in getting a behind the scenes look at how this works. Are you her de facto music director
I am
at
her
this point?
Complete musical director.
Okay,
that's what it says in my
contract. You are in name music director. Okay,
yeah,
even better.
Conductor,
so
musical director.
What does that entail? How do you work with her and with other musicians on a show. She still has her Vegas residency.
Correct.
Which, by the way, for those of you who don't know, once you go to Vegas and set up shop,
yep,
as a singer, as a diva, as a show, as a Penn and Teller, that means you have achieved a certain level of popular penetration.
Of course.
Where, you know, you, much like Billy Joel in Madison Square Garden for his monthly show, you're just a guaranteed ticket.
Right.
When would you say that shift occurred for her?
She did it in 2002, and from what I hear, I wasn't her musical director at the time. The brains behind it was Renee Angelil. Like, Renee Angelil, her manager, it was really Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis. That was a 50-50 deal. Renee Angelil was an absolutely brilliant man who had great audacious ideas, a lot of confidence, but he would risk things also. Like, he
yes,
put everything he owned into Celine, and obviously it paid off.
Yes. I believe he mortgaged his house for her first album. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the anecdote, and I think it's true. And he obviously, he had things in life that he liked. He was sort of a gambler and he liked to hang around Vegas, and that's probably played into it too. It was like a win-win. And I know some people at the time were very skeptical about the viability of Celine being a resident in Las Vegas, because at the time it was still a little bit of a graveyard for artists in mm-hmm. the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Like Celine, sometimes in her show at the beginning, she ad-libs all the time when she talks, and she'll switch subjects. Like, every show is different, we never know. But a theme she comes back to quite often is, I started here in 2002 and I was supposed to be here for 3 weeks and now I'm still here. So I think that she's really upped the bar. Like, they did construct the Coliseum for her, the 4,300 seat arena. I don't know if you've been there, but it's a beautiful, beautiful hall. Sight lines are great, the sound is really good. You know, when you think for the hotels, also for Caesar's Palace, if you have 4,300 people coming in four nights a week and she sells out every show, just think, if 500 people stick around and gamble for an hour, it's good for the casino. And it everyone opened up a lot of eyes. I think a lot of people started to look at Las Vegas with a lot less cynicism, you know, and start to be a little more open to it.
That's well said. Scenes in a daily operation of when you're working on a show.
Celine always has something cooking. It's like when we go to Las Vegas, we go for 3.5 weeks. We do 4 shows a week. Sometimes we have days off, and they're very good. Sometimes our days off are completely days off. But say she's doing the American Music Awards in 2 months. So we'll have a meeting, what song we're going to do. We'll check out the arrangement. If there's a new arrangement to be done, I'll take care of it. I love writing for orchestra, for strings and brass and everything. The show in Las Vegas, when I started with her, was August 2015. We revamped it quite a bit. We did about a third of the show was new at that time. And since then, we've changed about another third of the show. Like, the big hits are still there and haven't really changed. But a lot of stuff that was there before, like, I would redo some of the arrangements. It just consists of, like, I have a hotel room with a little studio in there, like Logic, like we have here. And I would do demos and stuff and write arrangements and send copies. And then we could go downstairs and it's sound check at 4:30, 5 o'clock, run through with the orchestra. And then Celine comes in at 5:15, and she's so fast. Like, she's just awesome. She just comes in and bang, and 9 times out of 10, she likes it, so I'm happy. And she's also... Celine, part of my job, a big part of my job, is to keep her stimulated. Like, she could come in and sing 2 songs and make sure her mic works and her earphones work and she's happy, but she always sticks around till the last minute. We're supposed to liberate the stage, free the stage at 6. She'll usually keep me till 6:10, 6:15. She likes to jam. She likes to say, do you know this song? And then we'll try songs together. Now we're in preparation for the Asian tour, so we had a set list prepared. Sometimes we'd take songs and take 5 songs, shorten them a bit, and create a medley and transitions, key changes, stuff like that. There's always something to do as her musical director.
I don't want to compare her to Michael Jackson, but I feel like she has the same sort of fluidity and fluency in music the way he does. From what I've observed, you know, in rehearsal and in performance.
Interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's physical too. Like, Celine moves well too. I know she's taken a little bit of lessons, ballet, stuff like that, and just doing what she does, obviously have to have some training. But obviously Michael Jackson was a dancer be-all, like, awesome. And Celine, to me, yeah, it's a good comparison. They just live music. They can sing anything they can hear. They can physically express it. They move well.
Are you in situations with her where you're sort of woodshedding or working on a tune or in the studio? And I wonder, like, what's the process there as far as artistic collaboration between music director and performer?
It's very fluid. Either she'll start something or any pattern that I start at all, she'll always start singing on top of it. And one thing that I discovered working with her the last 2-3 years, her talents as a lyricist, she comes out with these lines off the top of her head. She's just creative. She's just a fountain of ideas, musical, lyrical, all kinds of things.
Does she write her own songs?
She doesn't. I don't think she's been really given the opportunity. Like, I don't think...
You could see her doing more singer-songwritery.
I could see her... at least writing half the songs of a show, of a record, but it would be a real leap. Like, you know, she would need good collaborators and stuff like that, but she has ideas and she has things to say. Like, now it's no secret, like a 50-year-old woman, she has to have lyrics that relate to her life. Celine, if it's not believable, she's not going to do it.
And I think that's the thing for a lot of music that people forget is often we'll hear a song and say, this is good, this is bad, I liked it, I didn't like it. When really, that's shorthand for or were you convinced?
That's the key to it all. Were you convinced? And also, can you relate to it? Did it touch you? Like, there are a lot of people with good voices. Like, there are lots of people that sing well, but there aren't that many great artists and performers. When you mentioned Michael Jackson, like Prince, you know, people who are on that
next level.
Like, Celine, to me, is on that level.
For
like,
sure.
She's up there. They're born with a lot of it, and a lot of it is accumulated. Just, they're sponges. It's by osmosis. Just, they just absorb all this stuff from around them and mix that with a little bit of, Celine is extroverted. Yeah, with some extroversion, and she needs to perform. Mm-hmm. Like, she's on all the time. Like, even when she's not doing a show, if Celine comes into a room, she's the center of attention. It's very riveting. Yeah. A little bit of an exhibitionist, that's what I was saying.
I think at that level of performance, you have to be an extrovert, and you also have to be able to draw on your introverted tendencies when it's just you hammering a track. So,
yep. Depending on the lyrical content of the song, too. Like, she can close up and sing in her head voice so softly and so beautifully, and then next verse, belting it out, full chest voice.
Your voice is warm and tender. I'm your lady, and you are my man. Whenever you reach for me, I'll do all that I can.
You're about to become a Steinway artist.
So they say.
So they say.
I would love to.
That's happening. I've seen the paperwork.
Okay. I'm very pleased.
Tell me about your Steinway.
When we came back from our tour, last year we did a tour of Europe for about 2 months. And I said, you know, at this point in my life, if I do things right, I'd be able to afford it. And it's funny, when I was thinking back when I was first talking to you about when I was studying, like, there's no rap on my parents or anything, but I didn't really have a very good instrument to learn.
It makes a difference. And you don't know it as a kid.
I know.
You don't realize how much it's jangling in your ear.
Like, I have a tendency to over-pedal, and I know it, a lot of it is because when
you're trying to work that instrument.
Trying to make sound come out of it, you know?
Yep.
I bought my first grand piano when I was about 25 years old. It was a 100-year-old old Heinzmann. It wasn't very good, but Heinzmann is a good brand, but I mean, this piano, it had seen better days. And then I ended up with an Estonia, but it's funny, I mentioned Emerson, Lake & Palmer at the beginning of our interview on this record trilogy by Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Keith Emerson, in his credits, he talked about Moog synthesizer, but then he says Steinway piano Model D. And I know that really marked me. And I used to go to a lot of concerts. I still do.
Yeah.
And like 99% of the time at Place des Arts here in Montreal, there's Steinways. Like, Steinway's always been to me like the epitome of not only a classy brand, but also something that lives up to the reputation. So when I came back from this tour, I said, you know, let's do it. And I went to Piano Bozuk here in Montreal, and they were very helpful to me. So now I'm the proud owner of a Steinway Model B.
That's very good. I like the B. We often call the B our perfect piano.
I understand why. Mine is very rich and warm sounding. Being as it's brand new, it's not bright at all yet. There was a very good A beside it too, a really good sounding A, but I played on them both for hours and I remember thinking, you know, long term, just the resonance, mm-hmm. just the way the keys feel. Take the B, it's worth it.
And for solo piano recitals, I really like it as an instrument. It's warm enough, it has enough range. So listeners, the models go S-M-O-A-B-D. Of course, you're going to have the most control on the D. That's
right.
What we would call the concert grand. But again, I think for solo recitals, I really like hearing a B.
I plan on doing some recording at home too with my B.
When you play at home...
Yep. The lid is open.
That's good. Do you sit at the piano when you write or when you arrange, or do you tend to do that just
I tend
on the computer
to write,
or paper and pen?
My studio is downstairs in my basement, and I'm pretty traditional at writing arrangements. Yeah, I'm sort of pen and paper. Some people like to put stuff into a sequencer and send it to a copyist, but to me the process works better actually writing down the notes.
Mm, it's tactile.
My piano is upstairs, but sometimes I set a table beside it and I can arrange on the piano, but... Piano for me is kind of different. It's the inspiration. Sometimes I'll sit down at it while water's boiling for 3 minutes, and then sometimes I'll sit down at it for 4 hours. You know, it's just very centrally located in the house, and it looks amazing, and it sounds incredible. Like, and everyone, my children and my wife, they like it. It never bothers anybody. They're very good about that.
Yeah.
It's like they all like to hear it. And I like to hear my kids, too, playing on it.
Well, we are excited to have you. Good luck with your upcoming Celine tours. You said Asia is coming up.
Yeah, I'm excited. We're going to Tokyo, Macau, Singapore, Bangkok.
That just speaks to the universal power, of course, of all music, but specifically hers. I don't imagine that these are all fluent English speakers. That message carries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Emerson Lake and Palmer's arrangement of Aaron Copland's Hoedown on Manticore and Atlantic, Steinway artist Murray Pariah performing Chopin's Ballade No. 1 on Sony Classical, Stephen Osborne performing the 7th of Nikolai Kapustin's 24 Preludes in Jazz Style on Hyperion, Jeanette Renault performing L'Essentiel on Melon Miel, and Céline Dion performing Pour que tu m'aimes encore, My Heart Will Go On, and The Power of Love on Columbia and Epic. Our intro and outro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at listenmusicculture.com. Questions for the podcast can be sent to info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Thank you for listening.